Oban, continuation of the visit with Mr. Nealon this Tuesday morning, this unexpected visit, Tuesday morning, the 7th of August, 73. Channel 1 over, and a continuation of this unexpected visit with Mr. Nealon this Tuesday morning, the 7th of August, 73. Channel 1 over, and beginning of the continuation of the visit with Mr. Nealon, unexpected visit this Tuesday morning, the 7th of August, 73. Channel 1 over, and a continuation of the visit with Mr. Nealon this Tuesday morning, the 7th of August, 73. Channel 1 over, and a continuation of the visit with Mr. Nealon this Tuesday morning, the 7th of August, 73. Now, it's a long ways to where the talk begins. It's a long ways to where the talk begins. It's a long ways to where the talk begins. I turned the tape over before it was finished and I didn't run it out. It's a long ways to where the talk begins. It's a long ways to where the talk begins.
Okay, the barrel of the gum is 25 feet long.
Ooh.
And the two men get to toss it to you, and you have to catch it just right and zip it down the bore, and after that,
yeah.
Pour, put a powder bag goes after it, and then the percussion cap, the breech is closed, and bang, she goes. And four shots in 16 seconds is what we were able to do.
Let me tell you, Mr. Needle. Now, you knew how to sort of kick up a jackrabbit and where to find the deer.
Oh, yeah.
But now, there's a long way from that to following all them birds and giving them names.
Yes, well, that's all we had to be interested in.
I know, but you had to get the idea somewhere.
Well, we named them according to their coloring and their habits and where they built their nests. And
I have never in my life seen or heard of these young fellas growing up that named anything.
No, I noticed that. We were mentioning that the other day. The boy was in for lunch. And
well, now you read.
People don't know. Shot a duck. Well, what kind of duck?
Who? No, they don't know. Now you got into that somehow. You see something like that Abbott's History
well,
of the Navy.
Well, we just had to name everything. There were no books there.
Well, you had Abbott's History of the Navy. That's a book.
Oh yes, my oldest brother was a Navy crank, and that's how I came to get the book.
Yeah, he got it.
He saved up enough money to buy that book.
Yeah,
he was quite a Navy man. When he was a kid, he got in some 2x4s and he shaped them up, and he took old rifle ammunition shells, the long brass empty shells, and he made the turrets, and he had the various Navy ships reconstructed according to their actual equipment. And so when I was when he was 10, 12 year old. So he was interested in the Navy, so when he got older,
well,
he
well, how did he get interested in that, mister? How did he?
Oh, I don't know, just naturally. Yeah, we all have a bent for this, that, and the other.
Well, I know, but you were the only one that was actually interested in naming the animals.
No, the brothers were just as much interested.
Including your older brother?
The oldest brother was not much, very little.
But
the younger
two.
Brothers were especially good at it. Clarence was the next, 1 year younger than I was, very observant. And so we had to name him according to the very thrust. He came down with the robins from the north and spent the winter with us, and then went back to nest in the north, in Canada, and further north in the spring. So, well, he had a little reddish on his breast, and he came along at the same time, spent the winter with us as the robins did. So we called him an Arctic robin, because he went back to what we, you know, anything in the north is Arctic stuff, kids.
Well, I know, but now that's way along ahead. That's way advanced, Mr. Nealon. I've seen the children. And they don't look at anything enough to know anything
no,
like that.
No, I don't know. Are the parents to blame? What
I don't know about that, but I'm thinking about you. How you happen to be able to do that.
Well, we were interested. And then we'd have to round up the cattle and the cows, and that'd take us out in the range country and in the woods and the hills, and you'd see. We were determined to get a setting of every bird that nested there. And we pretty nearly accomplished
yes,
it.
Yes, but I don't know how you ever got that in your head.
Well, we were interested. There was nothing else to get interested in. No ball
you
games.
Had, you
no
had. Well, let me tell you, they used to, I remember when I was growing up, they used to have Arm & Hammer soda. They used to have those little bird pictures in them.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
And they'd have the name of it on this
side. We enjoyed those. That's where we learned some names.
And on the back, it'd tell you a little about them.
Yeah. We didn't get much of that. Just an occasional. I can't remember more than one or two that Arm & Hammer brand soda. Maybe Mother didn't buy much of that kind of stuff.
Well, even that would be a long ways from what you all did.
Yeah, we had to name everything according to what its characteristics and colors were.
Did you know about John Muir when you were out there?
No, I didn't know about John Muir till long afterwards.
Probably after.
I was 30 by that time.
Yeah.
But that's a man I admired tremendously.
Yeah.
John Muir, not only for his knowledge and his ability and his physical characteristics, but for his determination to conserve and save destruction. You know, he's the one that made the saved the redwoods.
Yeah.
They were cutting them down. Those wonderful big trees, they bore holes into the stem from all sides and put in dynamite. Dynamite was used there for mining all the time. You could get it, anybody could get it any time, and blast the beautiful tree down and then cut it up into stakes because it was very durable for their vineyards and orchards and things like that. And he just couldn't take that in Yosemite National Park in there, and he fought to save those trees, and he succeeded because he got Teddy Roosevelt on his side.
But it took him a long time to get it.
Yeah. He slept out. Teddy Roosevelt was a rough one.
Well,
and he slept out there under a blanket in the woods with John Muir.
But you
John
didn't know
Muir
about that.
John Muir convinced him that that was the thing to save those trees.
But you didn't know about that until...
Didn't know about that until 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Read about him. Then he went up to Alaska. Muir Glacier up there named after him.
Yeah.
And I was reading about that one time some years ago. And on his way up there through the snow and ice, he finally said, I'd better get back to camp because Darius is coming home. Then he went around by a different way, and before night came, there was an ice bridge across a deep gorge. And he said, and the dog followed him. At first, he didn't want that dog to follow him at all, but the dog just, in the wilderness there, I guess he just needed someone. So he said he finally managed to get, he was afraid the thing would crack and drop him way down there. He'd be dead by the time he hit the bottom of the rocky gorge. But he got across all right, but then the dog wouldn't go. Over that ice, that was too dangerous. He said the dog wouldn't go. He just stayed back there. So he said by that time he'd gotten sympathetic with the dog, so he got down on the ground and hid from the dog so that the dog would know he wasn't there anymore, would think he might not be there anymore. And Muir said he would peep every once in a while to see what the dog was doing. And he said finally the dog got up there where that narrow ice bridge was across there and raced across it just like lightning.
Now that's in one of his books?
Yeah, one of his books. I don't know now whether it's a book or an account. It might have been just a magazine account. I've forgotten. It's been too long ago.
Well, now, you had magazines.
Yeah, I get too many.
I'm still thinking about you naming the birds, Mr. Nealon.
Well, we had to name according to their colors and characteristics.
But you had magazines, and they talked about all those things.
Not then. I had no magazines. We had no books, no magazines, or anything.
You mean there was nothing?
Back in them lar hills,
nothing in California,
nothing
about wildlife.
Oh yes, if you could have gotten to a school or school library, I'd catch up with my lessons and I would ask the teacher, may I look at a library book. We had one little, what do they call it, closet, book closet there with books in them. And every time I would be reading one about birds or wild animals or something like that, I think there was only one little book about birds in there.
Yeah.
But I did read about the mockingbird
in the
South. We didn't have him there. So the only thing we learned till we got up well in our teens, in fact, till we got 18 or more, no books available on any.
Yeah, but you did have that little book on birds.
What little book was that?
That the teacher kept in the closet.
Oh, that was in the school library. And I wouldn't get much time to look at that. If your lessons and everything were caught up and you had done a good job on your lessons, and it was within 15 or 10 minutes of closing the school, and I'd ask for permission, the teacher would know that I was up and up on my schoolwork, so she'd permit me to read a library book. So then I'd always find the only one that had something about birds in it. Or animals, too. But our library was very restricted.
Well, it didn't have to be so big. Just enough to give you the idea.
Yeah, I'd give you a little information, but those books were written not all local birds. They were written for national birds.
You
wouldn't get much out of that. Now and then you could fit one in, but not many.
Yeah.
Pacific Coast birds are quite different.
The
bluebird out there, he's a little more colorful than our bluebird, but he's much prettier, brighter in color. We call them bullfinches.
Yeah.
I'd have a name for them.
Yeah.
And then the mountain bluebird is very modest in his covering.
Neil, before you go, let me tell you one thing I've learned from you. You see, you've got all this remarkable experience. Now, I call it experience. To me, that's just a very general name.
Run into things.
Yes, and you brought up out there.
Yeah.
And you see, you went up on that... let me tell you, you didn't tell us a thing about that lumber camp that you... You said you went up there at the lumber camp in the Sierras, but you never even mentioned the camp.
I didn't?
No.
Well, my name always gets me bothered so much. It was on Canyon Creek, which runs into Butte Creek, which soon runs into the Yuba River, which is one of the big rivers of our section. It goes down to Marysville and towards Sacramento. It joins up with the Feather River, and then they hit the Sacramento River together there.
Yeah.
Well, that river was up there. Where our lumber camp was the tributaries to the Yuba River. And... quite a large river. It flooded the town of Marysville because they did so much placer mining up there, washing the hillsides down, that the river sanded up in the valley until it got so high in the high water, the whole city was flooded. So they had to build 9-foot-high levees around the city, the principal.
That placer mining come pretty high, didn't it?
That's what?
That placer mining cost them.
Oh, they stopped it because they saw it was just ruining all the streams. They had to stop it way back there in the 90s. They stopped it. Probably in the 80s. But anyway... up there, it was logging on the National Forest, and I always appreciated it because those foresters saw to it that only overage trees were cut. No skin in the land the way they buy their way in now and ruin the country. So they had a hatchet, and on the back end embossed was raised letter U.S., and they chipped off down at the ground line some bark and hit it with the back of their hatchet, and there it was stamped U.S. The only tree we were permitted to plant, to cut, big tree, 6 and 7 foot logs.
Yeah.
Diameter, 7 foot logs. Two men with a 9 foot crosscut saw had to begin sawing over their heads till they got down to where they could saw all the way through. But to cut the tree is quite a trick, too, which I had to learn. I got with three experienced fallers. Anyone that cut down big trees in those days is called a faller. And the wedges were long, steel wedges.
What kind of wedges?
Faller's wedges.
Oh, is that what it was?
Yeah,
Faller's. F-A-L-L-E-R?
Yeah, F-A-L-L-E-R. So you look at your tree. How straight is it? Has it got some big branches to one side? Which side would likely be the direction it would fall? Naturally. But that wouldn't do, because that would crash into some younger trees and maybe destroy 4 or 5 young trees. Fine trees, 100 feet, 200 feet tall, slim, fine trees with a future in them. So you study the situation briefly, doesn't take you long. They got to fall in right over there, and then we'll miss all the young trees. Okay. When you get your axes, I got that job first.
Yeah.
I learned more. And you cut a notch in that tree about 4 or 5 feet long and about 3 or 4 feet deep, according to the size of the tree. As if you're going to chop him down. You cut in and down. That is placed so that that's where that tree is supposed to fall.
Yeah.
Then at the back end, two men begin with a crosscut saw, saw it down. Once their saw is well buried, you keep watching that tree all the time. Then you start a wedge on this side, a wedge in the middle, and a long wedge on the far side. All the time they're sawing, you watch that tree. After a while, you say, well, they're getting about halfway through. Is it tilting a little bit? Yes, just slightly. All right, we'll pound that wedge till we get it deep. Then it straightened it out. Then the other side looks as though it might tilt a little too much to this side, so you drive that wedge. And keep pounding those wedges. Then you drive the middle wedge. When you get it to leaning just where it should, you begin to pound the middle wedge. And finally, when they get almost sawed through, you pound the middle wedge until you direct that tree exactly where you want it to fall.
Well, now, where did you live?
Well, we had a little mill down the bottom of the stream where there was a little dam. And up the stairs there, they had a place where they had wooden bunks and you a proper laboring man always carried his bedding and linen blanket that were wrapped up in canvas on his back. And so you spread your blanket and your canvas down and some hay. They had animals there, 16 or 20 at a time, to drag the logs up where they could be used. And we put down some straw and then put down our canvas, and that's what we slept on. We weren't bothered too much with white sheets.
Well, how'd you eat?
And then there was a little boarding place there, a little kitchen-like place where they had some cooks, and they fed you there.
Well, how big was the camp?
Oh, I guess I'd have to think back. I don't think there was more than 50 workmen there.
There was three men on a tree.
Three men?
On a tree.
Yeah, usually three men on the tree.
Somebody to handle those wedges.
To do the sawing, and the other fellows to handle the wedges. Yeah.
And they figured the wedges was harder work.
Well, we shifted off.
Oh, did you?
So there'd always be someone. That gets to be pretty hard work if you didn't fool around there. We worked.
Yeah. You took a bite.
Put out everything we had on the course. That was the good old days when we still worked. Now people piddle around and waste most of the time.
Yeah.
No, I don't think they would up in that camp. They'd be fired right off. I was glad to get the job because they were paying me $35 a month.
And you were there all summer.
Yeah. When fall came, and it came early, they closed up.
They just couldn't make it.
They couldn't operate there after snow came. Down in the creek bottom where the mill stood, the sawmill, they were about 1/4 to a 1/2 mile below a steep mountain. And to walk up there, even we seasoned young fellows used to climbing mountains, you take 2 steps at a time in distance
time.
And you go up there, and we had to stop and rest twice before we got to the top.
Yeah.
Where the trees were cut down.
Yeah.
And so when the log, they had what they call a donkey engine. That's an upright steam engine. And long cables. And a horse to drag the cable way out there, several hundred yards to the nearest tree that had been cut down for logs. And then he'd fasten it and signal. And the donkey engine turned the steam on the drum and dragged that log in to the mill.
Yeah.
Then it was down about this steep from where the donkey engine stood to where the mill was, about nearly 1/2 mile, I'd say. You couldn't talk that far, you couldn't shout that far.
Yeah.
So then they made up those logs. Three, and the front log had a cable attached to it, spiked to it, and then they started them down, but there was one trouble there. It went down like this for a while, and then it was slanted off, and then it went all the way down straight. You had to let the log slide pretty fast to get over that more flat area and then start down where they could hold it back with the cable. Well, once in a while I have an accident.
Yeah.
That time I was working down at the mill. And I was always nervous about when they were lowering those logs for fear of a runaway. If one had gone through all the way down, going into the boiler, it exploded the boiler and killed everybody there. So I was working there, and I'd keep a watch every once in a while what was going on up there. And they was lowering those logs, and the whole back cable broke. It started down there too fast. Sometimes those big logs go a little too fast, sometimes not fast enough, and they couldn't afford to get them stuck there, then they'd be in trouble. So when they tried to hold them back, the cable snapped. Boy, I was way down there at the bottom. They had a signal there. The donkey engine had a noise signal, a tutor. And I kept looking up there to make sure those logs got started right. All of a sudden, I saw that little white steam popped out.
Mm.
I didn't wait for the sound to come down. Up the hill, I was at full speed. How long are you going to be down there when those logs shot through there? But fortunately, that time, they over-ended And none of them actually got all the way down. Big logs that go right through that mill as if it hadn't been.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What'd y'all do to pass the time, Mr. Nealon?
I didn't enjoy that with the rest of the boys. I'm no poker player.
They just played poker.
They played poker, but I went down the stream and sometimes make 50 or 75 cents pan and gold one way or another.
You didn't play poker at all?
I never learned how.
Well, now that is
I never had any money to waste. I was saving mine.
Yeah.
And so one reason I was able to get into school here, I had about $170 saved up.
Yeah.
And I
paid
my board and books to get in, and that got my goat. I had to buy a military uniform for $60.
Out there at that camp, those fellows that played poker, they got after you for not playing poker with them.
No, they didn't mind that. They were good-natured about that. I wasn't around, and they didn't see that I was cutting them off.
Oh, you lit out.
I would go down the stream a quarter of a mile or further half mile and size up where I might find a pothole. That's where the gravel is ground out around a hole that's just like a kettle.
Yeah.
And you get in there and pry out those. The gold is at the bottom. And I found one piece there, solid gold, be the end of my finger, probably worth $7 or $8.
Yeah.
But mostly it's fine gold.
Yeah.
But then when the stream gets very low in late fall, you work moss. The moss is on the rocks, and the high water washes sand and everything over, silt over them.
Yeah.
And then in that, you gather that dry moss and put it in your gold pan, grind it up fine, and start washing it. The black sand is heavier than white sand. And the last time around with your pan, if you let the water circulate, you see the white sand, back of that a streak of black sand, back of that a very fine streak of yellow gold dust. You put your little bit of drop of quicksilver on it, and you come out with a little pill of silver. And you put that in an iron spoon, don't get your face near it, some hot coals, and let that quicksilver evaporate off get away, and you got a little pill of pure gold.
Mr. Nealon, what they were doing, what you was doing when you was working up there, they was hiring you fellas out, you boys out, to get enough money so that you all could get away from there.
No, I don't think so. Out there, gambling in the old gold mining days got to be a deep-seated habit.
Well, no, I mean, when you got your water cut off, you see it at the
farm. Oh, you mean
farm,
when they dried us up?
When they dried you up.
Mm-hmm.
Then your daddy just hired you all out, or let you all go out there.
He didn't say anything much, except he said, "Well, you're pretty much on your own." So I was only 16, 17 then when I started, about 16, so I worked on the ranches for $1 a day pitching hay or running a hay rake down the river ranches, $30 a month some days for 31 days, and I often wondered why I didn't get $31. Anyway, that was all the pay you could get there. Then year I got a job at Palermo there where there were a lot of citrus groves. That was irrigated land too, but came from a different system than ours. They paid $35 a month and board. Oh boy.
Let me tell you what
happened.
That
beat where I was the year before. Then in the mountains, because the season is so short, they paid $3 a day. Boy, that's where I got my blankets on my back, and it took me 2 days to get up there.
So when you were 16, 17, and 18, that was 3 years, three summers in that range.
Worked hard.
You worked and made money.
Made a little money. And you didn't make much money. It cost you something to buy a gun and to keep in clothes. We bought our own clothes because we wanted the kind of clothes we wanted to wear, khaki.
Well, at least you had something to get on the train with.
A little, not much. Not much. When I got back, I had $175 from the mountains there.
Yeah, well, golly, that's something.
Left over, and by the time you buy your shoes and your clothes, it runs into some money.
Yeah.
After we were 16, we didn't the clothes.
Now, your other boys did.
We bought our clothes.
Your brothers did the same thing?
Yeah, they all did the same thing. We bought our own clothes.
Why did your older brother work at?
Oh, he worked in the mines mostly.
Well, I'll swear.
Running into a tunnel and wasn't a very good job either. It was pretty mean.
Yeah.
You got a go kart, you know, and you tunnel into the hillside and you carry out the rock and you get to hope you'll find a real vein of gold. Sometimes they don't.
Well, now, what that ranch you're talking about where you made hay, that's the hardest work you ever did, you said.
Oh, no, that wasn't the ranch that was the hard work. He did custom hay baling.
Oh.
And he moved about 40 miles or 50 away from his ranch with a hay baling outfit, a Bullard's Magic. 250 average weight of a bale of pressed hay with 235, but many of them were 240, some of them run 250, but if you came out with the 230, you'd get blessed out, the light bale. Somebody just shoveled in and didn't get quite enough hay into the chamber to bale it up into 240, 35, 40 pounds. Then they came out at the other end, two horses going round and round as fast as they could run to keep the power up.
Fast they run?
Yeah, they ran round and round on a long pole, hitched up in front and the man behind them with a whip to keep them running. Every 20 minutes you have to change them. That gave the fella that is working a few minutes to get his breath, because he had to get that hay piled in there as fast as a derrick fork could put a great load on top of him.
One man
stuffed it in there. Then at the other end, you had to, I enjoyed it because the change in what I was doing, you catch those bales, they had five wires around, they're just as hard as rocks, big bales, and you get your baling hook and the thing is rolled just like a hook, grab it and throw it up, jump on the next, throw it up, jump on the next one, throw it up, and then race back because there'll be another one waiting for you.
Now that's
16
that.
Hours a day.
That's half
$2 though.
That's half. Now I don't quite get that. You mean you pitched the hay in, and then you had to go out there and catch it?
Yes, you had these big derricks. You know what a derrick fork is? It's a big pine fork that you put in. And then you get into a stack, and they grab a big pile of hay and dump it up on the platform where he can push it down where the baling chamber is. And then when it gets baled, time those horses go around three times fast as they can run, you've got to have 250 pounds, 240 pounds of hay down that bale chamber where they come together. See, every time Bullard's Magic is an elbow like thing. Every time the horse goes around, the baling ends of the baling chamber come together to push that hay together. Then he has another bunch of hay in there and they come together again. Three times you shout up, last one on, You've got to get the last bit of hay in there, and the hay bale is made. Then five wires put on, rolled off, next bale coming.
And that was custom baling.
16 hours a day. Not entirely, but my job was, because I got the horses fed and watered at 4 in the morning, and we never stopped before 8 o'clock.
Yeah.
Sometimes 9.
So you
it was real work.
So you went to sleep pretty well at night.
Oh, we'd get a pile of hay out there under the stars, and nice breeze in the valley at night, sleep fine. Well, maybe you'll find something in there that you can use.
Yeah.
If not, if there's something else that you think you could use that I haven't included, if
I
you
know,
let me know, I'll dig a little deeper.
Yeah, I know one thing that we need. I'll get in touch with you.
One thing, eh?
Uh-huh.
Maybe you better write down this, and then I'll search and see if I can find it.
Let me tell you, the only thing we need is to cover your extension forestry time. We don't have a thing on that.
Oh, you don't? I think I included quite a bit on that.
Well, all we need is some experiences like you told us this morning.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you want more extension, I've got worlds of it in my files. Some things that I've tried to get done and something new, and they all turn it down, and
yeah,
maybe it'll take 30 years before it's finally acclaimed as the thing to do.
Yeah.
Anything new, you and I don't accept anything new.
Well,
maybe it's a good thing. It'd be too many fool ideas accepted.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you, Mr. Neal, this is one thing I've learned from talking to you. You see, you've got all this background of experience. Now, on top of that, you have been a public man, and you've had to get things done.
Yeah.
You go around, get them to put in red cedars.
I always try to take my work seriously.
Yeah, but you always got a program.
I had too many. I wish I could have done more.
But it's your programs now that interest you, and it's the programs that don't interest me. That is, I can take just a little bit of your programs if I get some of the experience to go with it.
Yeah, that's right. You need that. You wouldn't understand without experience.
Well, now, let me tell you what. Now, we give that a name. We call that the county agent mentality. You talk to the county agent, and all he'll talk to you about is these programs.
Yeah.
He'll never give you any of his experiences.
No. Well, most of them don't have any.
They don't now.
They come up the hard
way.
Now.
But you do. You've got that county agent mentality to such an extreme that it's very hard to get around it.
Well,
you get started on one of them programs and you just work the hell out of it.
Well, just too many. I wish I could have done more.
Well, the thing of it is, see, if we have just a little of that and a good bit of the experiences you had.
Oh, yeah, I see. That's
you
right.
See?
Now,
here's another thing. Here's another thing I picked up. Now, I didn't learn this from you. I knew this already. You make a statement. And these days, your statement that these old wood scows are a waste of time, you make that statement just as light as you can.
Why do you do that?
Because if you make it heavy, it'll kill it.
Oh, yes.
Nobody's going to listen to it.
I understand what you mean. That's true.
Yeah.
You can't go all the way in one day.
Well, that's right.
You have to take it in.
You make your statement, but you make it very light. Leave it, and then go off and leave it with all your experiences. Then
go off
and just look at some of these cows.
But I want it right away, and that's my mistake. You can't get it right away.
Yeah.
I think you got the right idea there. You have to feed them a little at a time. You can't gulp it all at once.
That's right. And you talk about, now that's what we call that, the counter-agent mentality, where you're always selling the program.
Yeah. Well,
and you're just hitting away, and it'll kill the program.
Well, I didn't kill mine. It just took longer to get them
adopted. I'm not talking about you out there. I'm talking about here. Now these fellas, like in the Audubon people, I found this out. Let me tell you how I found it out. I had some tape, and I was going to take it to class and turn the tape on so I could hear the students, because I found that when I got back to the office, I had forgotten what they said and who said it. Well, it turned out that it didn't work out. I couldn't get them on the tape, and they didn't talk connectedly enough.
No.
To mean very much. But what I did get was myself. And what I heard was just shook me. And one of the things I was doing, I was just knocking them down with all these statements, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And the time I got through knocking them down, they didn't want to get up. And that kind of opened it up, and I kept looking at it. And what I found is, these days, and I don't know what it comes from. It could be from television, you see.
Yeah.
On television, you don't have to holler at people.
No.
Just a very light statement, you see, will sound like an earthquake. And so I kind of learned, in a way, to lighten up on those statements.
Give it to them in smaller quantities.
Yeah.
But I don't know. You have so much opposition. If you have a good idea, you like to see it accepted.
Yeah.
I ran a farmer's co-op for 3 years.
Yeah.
And what made it so difficult? Dishonesty in people. Want to cheat somebody?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can't cheat him unless you're cheating your neighbor, and he doesn't like it. To keep him honest,
mm-hmm.
Not many, but two or three will give you an awful bad time. Well, a little simple thing. For instance, you're taking that much time. But
we don't have anything about your extension parts. All we need is a few experiences.
Just leaf through that, and what you need, let me know. It may be in my file.
No, we don't want anything in the file. We just want you to talk about some of your experiences.
Oh.
All the rest of it we can get.
Well, some of my experiences are down in words.
No. No.
You don't believe what you read. You believe only what you hear.
Now, this sort of writing doesn't give you experiences.
Well, I thought you could see the experiences in it. You don't get anything like that done unless you have experience.
No, I know it, but what we want is just your experiences as an extension, in your extension work. You have to have something in there, Miss Neal. We don't have one blooming thing. Nothing.
Why, I thought it was all built up on experience.
But we don't have any of the experiences that you had.
Think about all the difficulties I had. Maybe that'll bring experiences out.
We'll bring them out if you're just available. Mm.
There's things to do. We have plenty of lunch.
halfway through, say 800 or 1,000, and the end of the visit, Mr. Nealon, unexpected, this Tuesday morning, the 7th of August, 73. Channel went over about halfway through, and the end of this long, unexpected visit with Mr. Nealon is Tuesday morning, the 7th of August, 73. Channel 1 August, Channel 1 over about halfway through, and the end of this long visit with Mr. Nealon, unexpected visit with Mr. Nealon, is Tuesday morning, the 7th of August, 73.